Once upon a time, I worked at a movie theater in East Alton, Illinois. It was a lazy job with lots of downtime, and me and the other employees there sometimes passed the time away by prank calling the payphones in the shopping center across the street from us. We would talk to kids walking by, trying to freak them out by telling them what they were doing or what they were wearing. Sometimes we'd end up staying on the phone with them for hours, just killing time and chatting with them about nothing in particular. A few times, the random strangers would figure out who we were and they'd come over to visit with us. We made a few friends that way. One afternoon in the theater, I saw a lady pull up to one of the phone from car payphones in the parking lot. As soon as she rolled her window down, I dialed the payphone to make it ring, and she picked it up. "Hello, ma'am," I said to her. "This is the Illinois Bell operator. I need you to deposit the remaining 25 cents for the phone call you just made." "I didn't make a call. I just pulled up." "I know it was you that made the phone call. I was listening in on the conversation and I recognize your voice, so there's no use in denying it. Just put the quarter in the phone or I'm not going to let you use this phone." I can only assume that I won the argument because she finally gave in and deposited a quarter into the phone, just to shut me up. That's when I heard the tone for the first time. As I watched her stick a quarter into the phone, I heard a strange chirping noise come out of my phone. I'd never heard it before, but I knew it must be the sound that a payphone makes when you deposit a quarter into it. I was only slightly intrigued at the time, not realizing how valuable those tones were. The tones were referred to as Redbox tones by phone freaks, and they were used to signal the phone company's equipment that a quarter had been deposited. There were 5 chirps for a quarter, 2 chirps for a dime, and 1 for a nickel. By simply using a tape recorder to record those tones as quarters were deposited, a person could later replay them back into a payphone to get free calls. It was just a few months later, on a computer bulletin board system, then I found an article explaining to me what I'd heard. I began asking around about redboxing in the message areas on hacker BBSs. Everyone I encountered about it told me that redboxing was really big in the 70s and early 80s, but the phone company had fixed their system nearly a decade ago to make redboxing impossible. Trying to build a redbox would be pointless, they told me. I decided not to listen to anyone, and I tried it anyway. "I'm in a small town and it might still work here," I reasoned. "This sounds illegal," my manager Philip replied after I asked if he would pick up the phone and record tones for me while I ran over to a payphone and deposited some quarters. "It might be," I said, "but I just want to see if it works." "I'm going to pass on this one, Alex. You can do this on your own time. I have to draw the line somewhere." This particular manager was normally so easygoing when it came to my shenanigans, so I was really disappointed when he wouldn't help me out with this experiment. That night after work, I stopped by a closed gas station that had a payphone on each side of its parking lot. I deposited a quarter into one payphone and dialed the other one, then ran across the parking lot and picked up the ringing phone. I pulled out my portable Panasonic tape recorder and plugged a suction cup microphone into it, then licked the suction cup and stuck it onto the payphone's receiver. It was nearing midnight now, and I suddenly remembered that the city's police station was right across the street from me, and they might find it suspicious that a guy was running back and forth between 2 payphones, but it was too late to stop now. I ran back to the first payphone and began depositing quarters. I couldn't hear the chirping sound from my payphone, but I knew the other phone would. After I used up all $4 of my pocket change, I hung up the phone and ran back to the other phone to turn off the tape recorder. Not surprisingly, the payphone kept all the quarters I put in. I played back the tape and the tones sounded exactly as I remembered them from that day at the movie theater. I rewound the tape and got it ready to try and make a call. I dialed a random phone number in South Carolina, which was the only faraway area code I knew, and the automated voice told me to deposit $2.75. I began playing the tones, and the voice told me to hold for a live operator, letting me know that it wasn't working. I turned the volume down on my tape recorder, thinking that maybe the tones were distorted. This time, when I began playing my tones, I was able to play almost $2 before the automated voice interrupted me to tell me to hold for live operator. I hung up before the operator came on, excited that it seemed like it might be working. I turned the volume down another notch and tried again, this time making it all the way to $2.75 with my 11 bursts of chirping noises. A second later, I was rewarded with the automated voice thanking me for using AT&T. The phone in South Carolina began to ring, and someone's answering machine picked up. I was beyond excited that it actually worked. I hung up the phone and I began to laugh and exclaim things like, "Oh my God," and "Holy shit," and "I can't believe this," as I paced around in front of the payphone. After a while, I began dialing more numbers in South Carolina until I finally reached a sleepy woman. I can't recall what I said to her, but I decided to leave when a police car slowly passed by. It felt so surreal that something like this was possible. I thought it must be the payphone I was using. It must be really old and outdated, so that's why it was working. Over the next few weeks, I began trying different payphones all over town, and every one I tried worked. It sometimes took a few tries, but it always worked in the end. A week later, I made a better recording of my tones by using one of the indoor payphones at the mall and calling my answering machine at home. When my machine asked me to leave a message at the beep, I deposited as much as I could and then hung up. Waiting for me at home was a cassette tape with perfect-sounding Redbox tones on it. My new tape, combined with using perfected volume levels and just the right distance away from the payphone's mouthpiece, allowed me to make flawless calls every time. Since I didn't know many people who lived in other states, I would just dial random numbers and talk to anybody that would talk back to me. I would explain to them how I was calling by tricking the payphones. Some of them would lecture me about being honest, but almost everybody else I talked to thought it was impressive, or at least kind of interesting. So when I left home and arrived in Galveston, I managed to keep myself occupied on the payphones by redboxing calls to old friends and random people. I had a notebook full of cool numbers to call, like phone company news hotlines and test lines. Then there were all the overseas numbers, just calling them to hear their old recordings and trying to talk to foreigners. I also sold phone calls to people walking by in a few of the larger cities I lived in. I didn't realize it at the time, but I could have easily gotten myself into serious trouble by selling illegal phone calls. I guess I was lucky though because nobody ever reported me. If I saw a person about to make a phone call, I would stop and ask them if I could have their quarter if I'd give them a free call. Showing strangers how the tape recorded tones worked was a great way to meet people. I wasn't even charging very much for the calls. I was mainly doing it just because I was bored and liked to impress people with it. A year later, I was at a friend's house in Illinois, and he showed me a recent article from a hacker magazine called 2600. The article explained a very simple method of converting a small device from Radio Shack called a tone dialer into a Redbox. It cost less than $30 to build, and a week later, I had my very first tone dialer Redbox. It was only a quarter the size of the tape recorder that I'd been using for the past year, and it had three memory buttons along the top, which I was able to program as a quarter, a dime, and a nickel. The tones it produced were slightly slower than authentic tones, but it wasn't enough for AT&T's computer to notice. As far as I was concerned, it was flawless compared to my tape recordings, and it made redboxing long-distance calls easier than ever, since I no longer had to deal with a volume knob. From that moment on, I was never without my tone dialer Redbox. I would make marathon phone calls both to friends of mine and complete strangers. I would sit at payphones for hours at a time, pausing our conversations every few minutes to deposit more money. Occasionally, a live operator would come on the line and ask for the money. Normally, they wouldn't give me any problems, but sometimes they'd be able to recognize them as fraudulent tones, and they would lecture or threaten me. Considering the endless hours that I spent on certain payphones, it's hard to believe they never noticed the money missing from them. Or if they did, they sure never did anything about it. While redboxing a call outside of a convenience store in Texas, I got quite a scare from a phone company guy who seemed to come out of nowhere. I had just inserted a few dollars of tones for a call I was making. Right as I finished inserting the money and I set my tape recorder down, a man behind me touches me on the shoulder and says, "Excuse me." I turned around and was horrified to see a Southwestern Bells guide standing there looking at me. I'm positive my face turned away as my stomach dropped. But then he reached for the payphone and unlocked the coin box, scooting my tape recorder out of the way in the process. He was just there to empty the phone's coin box. After emptying the money into a bag and locking the phone, he left without saying another word to me. Another frightening incident happened to me while I was working at a Circle K in League City, Texas, when a cop walked in and purchased a coffee for me. We were the only ones in the store, and as he approached the counter and was ringing up his purchase, he said to me, "We've got a problem with those payphones outside." "Oh yeah?" I replied. "Yeah," he said slowly. "Apparently someone has been using a little gray box to make phone calls out there. This little gray box makes those beeping tones." And he began to do an impression of the tones that a red box makes. The police officer was eyeing me the whole time he said all these things, and it was obvious he knew something. I regularly used the payphones outside of the store to make phone calls, before and after my shift. I had no idea how the officer could know about it, or how he could know that I was the one responsible. His stare was unnerving, and I was at a complete loss for words. But before I could say anything, he smiled at me and said, "Scott told me about your tape recorder." I replied with, "Oh, it sounds like an interesting little toy. I've never heard of anything like that." He paused and smiled again before walking out the door. "Just don't do it anymore in this town." "I won't," I stammered. Scott was the assistant manager, and I'd shown him how the tape-recorded Redbox tones worked a few weeks before that. The next time I worked with Scott, he laughed and told me that the cops said I looked like I was about to faint. That wasn't the only time my various Redboxes had encounters with the police. While in Cincinnati, an officer stopped me and a few friends on suspicion of vandalizing a payphone earlier in the day. Yes, it was us. He searched my bag and held up the red box, asking what it was. I explained to him that it was a tone dialer that I used to store phone numbers, and he seemed satisfied with that answer. I gave a similar answer to the officer that arrested me for credit card fraud in Corpus Christi. When I was let out of jail there, my red box was returned to me in a Ziploc bag along with my wallet, money, and my keys. I was often selling my red box to people for profit, causing me to revert to using a tape recorder until I got around to buying a new tone dialer for myself. I once decided that it would be a while before I could afford to buy a tone dialer, since money was so tight at the time, so I improvised by encasing the innards of a tone dialer inside of an old Walkman tape deck. Of course, first I needed the innards of a tone dialer, so I purchased a tone dialer from Radio Shack, removed the circuit board and speaker from the inside of it, put it back together, and then got a refund for it. I was certain that a red box hidden inside of a Walkman tape deck was going to be the coolest thing ever, and that it would be sleek and completely inconspicuous, just like something James Bond would carry. But it fell just a little short of all that. Instead, it had multicolored buttons sticking out of the top of it for the coin and programming buttons, toggle switches sticking out of the back, and punch labels to identify everything. I even used a punch label to write "Ghetto 1200 Plus" along the bottom of the device. It was the most suspicious looking thing I'd ever owned. As atrocious as it looked, I used it for over a year, and it never failed me. It was bigger than a tone dialer, but slightly smaller than my usual tape recorder. When people saw it for the first time, they usually reacted with something along the lines of, "Oh my god, what the fuck is that thing?" Luckily, the police never saw it during the year I used it, since it looked a lot more scary than a tone dialer. It didn't take me too long to discover that I could also make international calls with my Redbox. The process was a bit more complicated and tedious than making a call within the United States, because I had to use a live operator, and I could only insert $3 at a time. Some of the calls to other countries would end up being close to $15, and it would take more than 5 minutes just to initiate the call. From there, I would have to be interrupted every few minutes to deposit more money. I enjoyed trying to talk to people with the different accents. I called up a lot of overseas airlines, since they could usually speak at least a little English, and kept them on the phone as long as I possibly could. Then I made calls to random numbers in English-speaking countries just to talk to strangers. The foreigners were usually intrigued enough by an American calling them to stay on the line and talk to me. I also liked hearing the different error recordings from around the world. I began to compile tapes full of the error messages from all the different countries. The operators would sometimes interrupt the error messages when I would try to record them, telling me that the number was disconnected, and I'd have to yell at them to shut up and to put my disconnected number back on the line. Some operators could tell the difference between real tones and fake tones, mostly because the chirps on a tone dialer were spaced a little further apart. So they would forward my call to their supervisor or threaten to send the police to my phone. I always scoffed at their threats, but I never hung around a phone much longer after they said they were going to send the police, just in case. Sometimes the operators would offer to send me a refund for the initial $3 or $6 that I deposited if the number was disconnected. At first I declined, saying that I was a billionaire and that all these quarters were mere chump change to me. But after a while I began accepting their offers for free money. Before long my post office box began filling up with $3 and $6 checks from AT&T. After realizing how easy it was to receive refund checks, I stopped caring so much about making international calls and began to concentrate on receiving larger refunds. I made a list of international phone numbers and exactly how much each international call would cost. I kept trying different countries and taking note of the most expensive places to call. Then I would make a call to the AT&T operator, not even bothering with inserting any of the fake money. AT&T, how may I help you? The operator would ask. Hi, I was making an international call using my spare pocket change that I stole by breaking over a Pepsi machine on 86th Street, and the phone went dead and kept all of my money. Could you redial the call for me? I'm really sorry about that, sir. Our policy won't let me put the call through for you, but I can refund the money to you in the mail. Oh, all right, I replied. How much money did you lose, sir? $11.85. How could you lose that much? We only let you deposit $3 at a time. Well, I dialed the number and the operator came on the line. She told me that it was going to be $11.85. So she had me put in $3 three different times. Then she had me put in $2.85. She told me thank you and then the phone went dead. After asking which number I was calling and confirming that the amount for the call was the same amount that I was claiming to lose, the operator would agree to mail a check to me. The key was to know exactly how much money a particular international call would cost. As long as I had that information, they always seemed to believe me. Once I perfected this routine, I started making about $100 each week from it. For someone who worked a minimum wage job, an extra $100 every week was quite a bit of money. Just as I was considering quitting my regular job to do coin refunds full-time, I received a letter from AT&T. It read, "Dear Alex Carbon, our records indicate a large number of coin refund requests. In light of this history, we cannot provide a refund until AT&T investigates and verifies this claim. As part of this investigation, please provide us with the written detail of the call and circumstances in which you lost your money." The letter provided me with an address where I was expected to write to them with the details of my loss. Of course, I never attempted to go that far with it. It looked like my coin refund days were over. That is, until I got the idea to use my fake IDs to start mailing myself checks under different names and addresses. So that I wouldn't appear to be the same person, I looked up a random person in the phone book and filled out a change of address card using their address and my new fake name. This way, all of the mail being sent to this random address under my fake name would arrive at my post office box. Then I just used my check cashing account at a supermarket to continue to cash my refund checks. I filled out change of address cards for random addresses all over the country using different fake names, and I kept the occasional AT&T refund checks coming to me for several more years. I made sure to keep them under $100 per month, hoping that it wouldn't raise their suspicions too much. I still received a few more letters from AT&T, though, sent to some of the other addresses. My red boxing habit died down a little as I discovered easier ways to make free phone calls with calling cards, credit cards, and with call forwarding. But I always kept my red box with me and enjoyed showing it off to people and helping them build their own. In 2002, AT&T stopped accepting coins for long-distance calls. This had nothing to do with red box phone fraud, but it was because most people were beginning to use wireless phones and prepaid phone cards. Today, it's still possible to red box local and intrastate phone calls. Some people can even manage to make long-distance calls with a red box, but apparently it's getting harder every year and it's barely worth the effort just to save 50 cents. It's amazing to think that for 30 years, AT&T couldn't figure out a way to stop people from using red boxes. And the ability is only just now beginning to diminish because they've completely turned off the equipment used to complete phone calls made with coins, mostly because payphones aren't used as much as they used to be. For me, it was a fun decade of free calls, giving me a head start before the rest of the country would begin experiencing super cheap long-distance rates around the beginning of the millennium, with flat rate long-distance and free nights and weekends. Thanks for making it so easy, AT&T.